Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Its very name has become synonymous with beauty. We value just about anything made with it. But what about its history? In fact, as we will hear today, it is interesting indeed. And we're talking about porcelain, and in particular, perhaps the finest porcelain of all, Meissen porcelain. But before we get to that subject, let's take a look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1936, fascist general Francisco Franco was proclaimed head of the insurgent Spanish state. Born in December of 1892, Franco began his meteoric military career as a second lieutenant in the infantry academy at 17 years of age. By 1926, he was already a brigadier general and national hero for the right-winged conservative cause. While Franco was looked upon as being a statesman by other conservative Spanish factions, he was referred to as the butcher by liberals for his swift, violent action against anti-government uprisings. When a leftist Popular Front government came to power in 1936, Franco was basically exiled to the Canary Islands for military duty. The new regime did not last, however, and by October of 1936, he was proclaimed Generalissimo and the head of state by the nationalist movement. A bloody civil war raged on for 3 years before Franco's conservative forces could claim unconditional victory. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, more than a half century after it was lost in the chaos of World War II, a wealth of music written by composer Johann Sebastian Bach has been discovered in Kiev, Russia. Christoph Wolff, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, has been tracking many leads since the scores were taken from Germany by the Soviet Union in 1945. Among the many musical documents are various works from some of Bach's 19 children, including those by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. While Wolff hopes that one day the music will be returned to its rightful home in Germany, no final decisions have been made about its future. And official KGB documents recently handed over to the Clinton administration make public the private pleas Jacqueline Kennedy made to the Russian government following her husband's assassination. In the correspondence, Mrs. Kennedy urged then Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev for a continuation of self-control and restraint in U.S.-Soviet Cold War relations. While the documents shed little light on the Kennedy assassination, they do reveal that the Soviet Union was appalled when accused of being involved in it. At the time, such American accusations were encouraged by Lee Harvey Oswald's alleged Soviet communist connections. You're listening to Talking History. You may never look at your fine porcelain objects in quite the same way again after you listen to our show today. At the very least, you'll have a better appreciation of its history, which is the subject of Eileen Dugan's talk with art historian Janet Gleason.
An imprisoned alchemist, a luxury-loving, woman-chasing duke, a host of scheming courtiers, the race for a secret formula. Sounds like the trappings of a romantic work of fiction, right? Wrong! These are, in fact, key elements in the birth of one of the most glorious industries of early modern Europe, that of Meissen porcelain. To this day, in the opinion of many, 18th century Meissen porcelain remains unsurpassed in its beauty and quality. Who can imagine the intrigue and tragedy which begat such sublime creations? Joining us today to chronicle the rise of Meissen is the art historian and author, Ms. Janice Gleason. Ms. Gleason is the author of the recent book, The Arcanum, The Extraordinary Story. And extraordinary it is indeed. Welcome, Ms. Gleason.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, today, as you know, we take porcelain or china for granted. We have dinnerware, knickknacks, even bathtubs made out of porcelain. Why was porcelain considered white gold in the early 18th century?
Well, the thing was that at the time, the only true porcelain available to Europeans was imported from China and Japan. And the substance had been named by Marco Polo after a Portuguese word, which was porcelana, which meant pig, or a vaguely sort of pig-shaped shell. And people were fascinated with the substance, firstly because there was nothing like it in Europe, And because also it was so full of contradictions, it was a substance that did look a bit like a shell because it was semi-translucent. It was non-porous, which meant it was very, very good for drinking tea and coffee and chocolate out of, which were all drinks that had just become fashionable. And yet the amazing thing about it was that it was incredibly strong.
And why weren't the Europeans making their own porcelain?
Well, they tried, but the Chinese and the Japanese, who also knew how to make it, were very, very reluctant to share their knowledge with the Western world because they had this hugely lucrative trade and export, and, you know, why spoil it? Mm-hmm. And so various entrepreneurs and rulers had tried their best to discover it, but the key to the substance was firstly the right ingredients, which turned out to be a type of clay called kaolin or China clay. With that, you needed feldspar or some sort of a flux that would melt and fuse with the clay to make this glassy, semi-vitrified substance. But the main thing you needed was a very, very high temperature. And none of our kilns at the time had ever reached such a high temperature. So it was really quite a complex process that no one in Europe had yet mastered.
And porcelain was also very expensive and very treasured by the wealthy. Who were the leaders in this porcelain mania that you described?
Well, they tended to be the sort of fashion setters of the time, the trend setters. And just like nowadays where we read the glossy magazines about rich people who set fashions, in those days it tended to be rulers and noblemen and very wealthy entrepreneurs. And one of the key collectors of the time was Augustus the Strong, the ruler of Saxony, who was so mad on porcelain that he said it was like oranges. You could never have enough of either one. And in fact, he went to such extremes with his porcelain collection that at one point he swapped a squadron of dragoon guards for a collection of porcelain because he thought that was a good deal.
So Augustus the Strong is very much a lover of ceramics, a lover of porcelain. He's also a lover of gold, and this is where Friedrich Böttger comes into the story. How did he get involved in gold and porcelain?
Well, Friedrich Böttger, who's sort of the hero of the story in a way, was a young apothecary when the story begins, and he was apprenticed to an apothecary in Berlin and studying madly. But during the time he was an apprentice, he became sidetracked by the subject of alchemy, and in particular, he became very, very intrigued in the search for the Philosopher's Stone. And this is a substance which everybody thought at the time, if you could just find the secret formula or arcanum, you would be able to turn base metal into gold and also make yourself immortal. And Böttger became completely convinced that this was a possibility and started doing experiments on the side and putting on sort of magic shows which convinced people that he really did know the secret of turning metal into gold, although, of course, it was all a bit of a trick, a bit of a David Copperfield illusion. But the shows were so convincing that the ruler of Prussia, where he was studying, decided to send for him, and he was very worried about being caught out, so he escaped into the neighboring state of Saxony, where Augustus heard about him and had him imprisoned and brought to Dresden and thrown into prison at the age of 20, and threatened with being beheaded if he couldn't actually produce gold.
And was he able to produce gold?
Well, of course, he wasn't able to produce gold, but on the way, while he was doing his frantic experiments, he became friendly with another nobleman called Baron Tischenhaus, who was involved in experiments into discovering the secret of porcelain. And because Böttger had done extensive experiments into heating minerals, he did have a lot of knowledge in that field. And so he decided that if he spent a bit of time working on the porcelain formula, it might help spare his neck because he wasn't having much success with discovering how to make gold.
And was Augustus the Strong amenable to this?
Well, he was, because Augustus the Strong, as we said, was a great porcelain lover. And he was also desperately trying to emulate Louis XIV of France, who sort of set himself up as this great patron of the arts, and his country was producing all sorts of different industries, and most of the rulers at the time were very, very keen to encourage local industry, firstly to make themselves prosperous, but also because it was something of a status symbol.
And how did Boethger actually find the arcanum for porcelain at last?
Well, I think it was really through trial and error and very, very rigorous experimentation. And the records state that he had clay from every clay pit in the land, samples of clay were sent to him, and just literally from heating them, different mixtures, different temperatures, and recording each of these experiments, eventually he managed to narrow it down and find a form of porcelain, which wasn't perfect to begin with, because he in fact fused the kaolin with alabaster into the feldspar, which was later used. And so this gave a sort of yellowish tinge to the porcelain, but it was still a vitrified substance that was recognizably porcelain.
And he was able to devise kilns that were able to fire these porcelain?
Yes, he realized that temperature was crucial, I think because of his work with gold. And so he was able to develop his own kilns, because nothing at that point had been developed which was capable of such high temperatures. And to begin with, these kilns were tiny, so only very, very small pieces could be made. But as the technique was perfected, larger ones were built. And then larger things like dinner plates and vases and larger sculptures were able to be fired.
So the Meissen factory developed, and what kinds of challenges did the factory face in its early years?
Well, I think it faced immense challenges. I mean, there was, first of all, the problem of corruption, because everybody saw it as a way of getting rich quickly. And whether you were the sort of the local guard on the door or the supervisor, you know, everyone wanted to have their finger in the till. And there was also an endless sort of stream of people from neighboring princedoms and states, very happy to pay off anyone who would share a bit of knowledge with them. And then, as well as that, there was the poor old Boethger, who was still stuck in prison for most of his life. And by the end of it, by the age of mid-30s, he'd suffered from serious depression. He'd turned to drink. His eyesight had been damaged by the glare from all these experiments. He'd been poisoned by toxic fumes, and really he was in a very, very poor way indeed. And he also talked too much because he was so miserable, and crucially told people who took the secret elsewhere. And also, I mean, there were huge technical problems to surmount. Although they discovered how to make a porcelain body, it wasn't perfect. As I said, they were using alabaster, which gave the porcelain a sort of yellowish color, which they didn't particularly like. And they had enormous difficulties in trying to discover how to decorate it, because colored enamels were another great technical hurdle.
Was Meissen able to keep the arcanum for porcelain a secret?
Well, no. They were very, very keen to try and keep it a secret, obviously, because when they first discovered it, they had this amazing monopoly throughout Europe. But, there was a huge sort of skullduggery and espionage and just basically people who were very, very unhappy with the way they were treated. And gradually the secret got out, so that within 20 years, I mean, there were about a dozen or more factories who were all producing porcelain.
And what do you think were the most fantastic pieces created at Meissen?
Well, to me, the most amazing things were the pieces made for the Japanese palace, which was Augustus the Strong's sort of showpiece palace he had built in Dresden. And on the first floor, he decided that he would have a whole porcelain menagerie. So he commissioned a worker called Candler to make a series of life-size and almost life-size animals and birds. And these objects are absolutely incredible. Some of them are 3 foot or more high. And they still exist today in museums. And although many of them are flawed, because it was very difficult to make such massive pieces of porcelain, they are incredible.
And there were also some massive surface settings as well, weren't there?
Yes, they made enormous surface settings. I mean, thousands of pieces strong. When, after Augustus the Strong died, his son took over the kingdom of the Electorate of Saxony, and he wasn't particularly interested in porcelain, so he got his prime minister called Count Bruhl in to look after the factory. And he was very keen on porcelain, and he commissioned a wonderful service called the Swan Service, which has more than 2,000 pieces in it. And each object is based on the theme of water, because the word brule means marshy ground. So it's got shells and swans and fish and all sorts of wonderful imagery on it.
Well, over the years, of course, the personnel would change at Meissen. And how did that influence the look of Meissen porcelain?
Well, very greatly. And so the factory, in the period covered by my book, it goes through very distinct phases. First of all, you have the Butzer period, where the pieces were very small and imperfect. And then there's the arch-villain of the story, a man called Herold, who arrives from Vienna and manages to sort of inveigle his way into power. And he was a very corrupt and venal man, but he was a brilliant artist, and he really managed to surmount this problem of coloring. And under him, the painted decoration, which the factory made, just achieved incredible heights of perfection. And you get the beautiful flowers, the oriental designs, harbor scenes, animals. I mean, the range is absolutely wonderful. And then when Augustus the Strong got a bit fed up with Herold's painted decoration and wanted more sculptural forms, this man called Candler arrives. And gradually the painting becomes simpler, but the sculptural designs become incredibly elaborate. So you get teapots in the shape of cockerels and the most wonderful shapes and forms. And the thing we associate most with Meissen, of course, which is the little figurines that Candler actually made originally, not to stick on your mantelpiece, but to decorate the center of great big banquet tables.
So would you consider Meissen a trendsetter or a trend follower in porcelain design?
Well, to begin with, it was very much following the Oriental lead, because that was the established market, and they felt they had to rival what China and Japan were doing. But gradually, as they became more proficient, they themselves set trends and fashions. And so much so that really the Meissen factory dominated the whole of porcelain made in Europe for probably the first three quarters of the 18th century.
And apart from this being just a really interesting story of the Arcanum, what is the significance of this story to the history of chemistry and to European history and European industry?
Well, I think that it sort of represents a turning point in industry, because suddenly you have this factory which at its height was employing more than 500 people, and they were all intensely specialized workers. You know, one man specialized in painting roses, somebody else specialized in painting the little sword on the bottom, somebody else did harbor scenes. And so really it's the beginning of specialized industry as we know it today. And the other amazing thing I think about it is that the formula that they discovered then has really hardly been changed, and the porcelain that the Meissen factory still turns out is basically the same substance as that made, you know, in the early 18th century.
All right, well, thank you, Ms. Gleason.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We have been talking with Ms. Janet Gleason, author of The Arcanum, The Extraordinary Story.
Turning from one delicate matter to another, but this time of a diplomatic nature, we address the potential for another Cold War, this time with China. Here to give us his thoughts on the matter is Henry Butterfield Ryan, an associate of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy. Butterfield is also the author of The Fall of Che Guevara.
Are we stumbling into a Cold War with China? Great powers like male dogs tend to fight. It's a reflex. And today, the U.S. and China are growling at each other. So what can we do? First, we can resist the temptation to meddle in China's internal affairs, repulsive as they may sometimes be to us. When the American Republic was young, we assumed that other nations, if they were wise, would follow our democratic example, but we would not try to force them. John Quincy Adams said in 1821 that the U.S. goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is the well-wisher to the independence and freedom of all, but she is the champion and vindicator only of her own. Still, influential voices in this country want us to ignore Adams' advice and pressure Beijing into liberalizing its internal policies. Largely for that reason, Christian groups, trade unions, and many politicians oppose normal trade relations with China, for example, and resist China's entry into the World Trade Organization. Remembering the Tiananmen Square massacre, many Americans understandably sympathize with those views. But to endanger our relations with a potential superpower because of how it governs its own people is contrary to the primary duty of the President and the Congress, that is, to enhance the well-being of the people of the United States. Secondly, we should remember that China has good reason to fear the U.S. We have intervened in its affairs since the first half of the 19th century. Then, when Europeans and later Japanese were carving out spheres of influence in China, the Americans insisted that whatever trade terms others got, we wanted the same. We also insisted upon immunity for U.S. citizens in China from Chinese laws, a status they enjoyed from 1844 until 1939. We have also intervened militarily in China. The last time was in the late 1940s, when U.S. Marines guarded trains, mines, and other facilities for the Chinese nationalists, then fighting the founders of today's communist government. In 1950, during the Korean War, when Chinese soldiers pushed U.S. and Allied troops away from China's borders, many influential Americans, including Douglas MacArthur, commander of our forces, called for war on China itself. Furthermore, President Harry S. Truman in 1950 said that the atomic bomb might be used against China. American legislators and policymakers should recall some of this history when dealing with China. So then, should we bow to Chinese geopolitical demands? Of course not. We were right to oppose Chinese sales of nuclear technology, and we should continue to do what little we can to get China out of Tibet. And certainly, we should remain firmly at Taiwan's side until it can take a secure place in a democratic China. But we still should remember Adam's warning not to go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. That includes Chinese dragons.
You've been listening to Henry Butterfield Ryan, an associate of Georgetown University's Institute for the Study of Diplomacy and the author of The Fall of Che Guevara. Ryan's op-ed comes to us courtesy of the History News Service. This is Talking History. Returning to our discussion of fine porcelain, we've chosen for our site of the week the place where Meissen porcelain is produced. And here to tell you about that historic place is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The public section of the Meissen porcelain manufacturing plant in Germany is the most extensive array of models, totaling more than 20,000 pieces. About 3,000 items a year are chosen for public display, so the exhibit is never quite the same from year to year. The models are also borrowed by painters and repairers in the midst of restoring historic pieces. The models on display at the Porcelain Museum paint only a selective picture of the three-century-old history of Meissen porcelain, although it offers a nice, authentic impression of the design trend over the many years. One cannot help but notice the attention to detail in the objects that range from the size of a thimble to a centerpiece that rises more than 12 feet in the air, made in 1749 for August the 3rd.
As part of our weekly coming attractions, we suggest you tune into the final two segments of the PBS series, The Red Files. The series is intended to provide the Soviet Union's view of the major events in recent history through interviews with key Soviet participants and never-before-seen archival film footage and recently declassified documents. Episode 3, which airs October 11th, titled Secret Soviet Moon Mission, tells the story of the mastermind responsible for the Soviet space program. Episode 4, Soviet Propaganda Machine, examines the Soviet Union's attempt to control the hearts and minds of its people during the Cold War. And while you're checking your local listings for the Red Files, look out for the Turner Network, Hallmark Entertainment television production of George Orwell's Animal Farm, an allegorical novel published in 1945 that tells the story of the animals of Manor Farm who overthrow their human masters. people's place in the world, Orwell tries to show, does not depend on our own efforts, but on what we are, meaning what place we occupy in the system. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we'll examine the history of bachelors in America. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Lebeau. Thank you.